You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
My investigations and conversations around blood phosphate from the Western Sahara continue. I've been struggling to understand why we rely on phosphate so much, apart from the fact it's just the way we do things, because surely we can do things differently if it's not working. During the broadcast of one of my earlier pieces, one of you listeners got in touch telling me about the possibility of using too much phosphate. They suggested I speak to Kay Baxter from the Kōanga Institute, so I reached out.
So I guess I'm a home gardener, but I'm a pretty passionate and I'm a hardcore gardener. We grow all of our food. We grow all of our food and have done for a long time, which includes all of our vegetables and grains. And I've always been an organic gardener, and for the last 30-odd years I've been extremely committed to, like, finding regenerative solutions, because currently everything we do in the industrial world degenerates everything. So, like, all of the ways that our food is grown in the industrial model degenerates the soil, degenerates the quality of the plants, and degenerates human health. So we cannot, and degenerates the whole ecosystem, the whole planet. So we're in a bad way. And
that was Kay Baxter. She works at the Kōanga Institute, which is the home of New Zealand's largest heritage food plant collection. It is a non-profit organisation registered with the New Zealand Charity Commission. They are also leading practitioners, researchers and teachers of bio-intensive gardening and nutrient-dense food production for home gardeners. What this organisation is seeing is that seed saving and heritage tree growing is only the first link in the food and human ecology chain. And, as Kay said, what we need to be doing is operating with regenerative practices. The term regenerative describes processes that restore, renew, or revitalise their own sources of energy and materials, creating sustainable systems that integrate the needs of society with the integrity of nature, something that we have done in the past. And something Kay cares strongly about, along with the organisation she works for. So, you might ask, what does this have to do with phosphate? Kay explains.
I guess around about, in relationship to the phosphate issue, around about 15 years ago, I started hearing things saying, oh, we're at peak phosphate, we're at peak everything. Like, first of all, it was peak oil, then it was peak everything, and one of those things was phosphate. So I started thinking, So we need phosphate to grow plants. Even organic gardeners need phosphate to grow plants. And organic gardeners just buy organic versions of, the same mine stuff. Mm. So what do we do? What's the story here? How did our ancestors grow plants without mining phosphate in someone else's? And I've also been to Jordan and seen the mining, the strip mining. It's insane. Like, it's absolutely insane what we do to other countries to get our phosphate. Like, we ruin them, completely ruin them, leave them like toxic wastelands. It's totally not okay. So if we're going to find, I'm always looking for solutions. So one of the first bits of information that came to me that helped me have some hope that we could find another solution was I was studying with a man called Arden Anderson, who teaches biological agriculture around the world, or mainly New Zealand, Australia and America. He's an American doctor and soil scientist. And he was explaining that phosphate, in the growth process of plants, phosphate is like the usher at the wedding. It like stands at the door, at the entrance to the roots of our plants, and it's got... and it carries in the minerals into the plant on its back electrically. They're electrically connected, energetically connected, and it carries them in, and then it goes up. And what phosphate does is it catalyzes or initiates the photosynthesis process. So photosynthesis doesn't happen without phosphate.
Right.
So phosphate catalyzes the photosynthesis process, and it drops the minerals on its back into the sugars that are made in the photosynthesis process. But phosphate isn't used up in that process. It goes right back down to the roots and brings in the next lot of minerals. So phosphate isn't used up in the growth process of plants or building of the cells, but it cycles around and round. So I'm thinking, so why is it disappearing? Why are we needing to keep pouring it on? Why is this something we need to be importing?
Yeah.
And so then I've been doing a lot of study, and I started to understand that what is happening in the soil and what has happened in the soil over the last 100-odd years is that because of the way that we are managing, because of the industrial agriculture and horticulture systems, what we do is we mine the carbon. And the carbon levels get lower and lower and lower, which is part of why this, you know, that we see the carbon is ending up in the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
So, and because the carbon levels in the soil are getting lower, our soil has less and less ability to hold the moisture and hold the minerals, including phosphate. So if the carbon, if the phosphate cycles, initiates photosynthesis process, goes back down to the roots, out into the soil, and there's nothing there to hold it because everything happens, like everything's electrical and everything has a charge. And the carbon in the soil is negatively charged and it holds all the positively charged minerals. And so because they bond together, so there's nothing there to hold it. So it ends up becoming water soluble and washed away and just disappears. So we constantly have to put more on. So that gave me another clue, understanding that. So when I understood that, I realized, okay, so our first job is to be raising the carbon levels or building the humus levels in the soil again. So I've been learning how to do that over many years. I'm a home gardener. I work with home gardeners. So everything I do is really at the home gardener level. So I basically work with compost. And I've learned that most of the compost I made for most of my life was pretty useless, and I've learned now how to make amazing compost and how I can grow nutrient-dense food and build soil using my compost. And I've raised the carbon levels in my garden beds. When we came here 10 years ago, the carbon levels, the humus or carbon levels in the soil were 4%. And in my garden at home now, they're 30%. So I've built an unbelievable amount of carbon in the soil. And as I've built the carbon, it becomes easier and easier for me in terms of the phosphate. Although phosphate is still quite a challenge. So the soil holds the phosphate a lot better. It's not disappearing anything like the way that it was before. And I'm not having to put phosphate on in order to grow plants. However, the next really major thing that I've discovered, I'm keeping looking for ways to, I've got a refractometer and I test the bricks of my plants, the nutrient density, which is the sugar levels, you know, in the plants. And so it's actually phosphate, high levels of available and balanced phosphate, you have to balance it with potash, that create high bricks as a nutrient dense food. So it's a really, really important one. And without high and balanced levels of phosphate, you don't get high bricks food and you're not building soil fast. So it's really critical. And I don't want to buy phosphate. So I've been looking at all the things in our environment that we can cycle around and add phosphate to the compost heap. And one of the ways I've done that is by growing lupins and oats as compost crops over the winter, because both of those crops are pretty good at accessing, unlocking and integrating phosphate into their cellular structure, well, you know, into the oats and lupins. And then you put that in the compost. Burnt bones and eggshells and things like that. There's phosphate as well as calcium there, so I do that. But I've come to the understanding that most of the phosphate in our world is being accumulated and excreted by the animal world. So basically, there's kind of lots of learnings here and they all overlap.
No, it's great.
The phosphate one, but one of the things that I noticed here, when we came here, this was a sheep farm and the grass was all short and they had a bricks of two and the carbon levels of the soil were four and you couldn't grow anything really. So essentially all the minerals have been exported to England mainly over the last 120 years and they're probably now all in the North Sea, you know, and they went over in the form of sheep meat and sheep bones. So we've got to start again.
That means that because the animals have eaten this grass.
Yeah, well, there would have been much higher carbon levels in the soil, and the way that the sheep have been managed makes the grass. Well, that's another story. I'll keep off the animal one because we have solutions to that as well, and it's fairly simple, actually, much simpler. It's much easier to turn this around with animals than it is in a garden, in an annual production garden.
Right.
So in the annual garden, Well, what I saw happening was, so once we came here 10 years ago, we started planting loads of trees. We've planted thousands and thousands of trees, and some of them are 10 years old now, and, you know, and everything in between. And we've got our little gardens and, you know, in on our house sites with trees around, orchards and forest gardens. And what we noticed was that as we planted plants and there were lots more insects around, there's heaps more insects here than there ever were before, and they came quite quickly. Within 2 or 3 years, the insect population went through the roof because we were looking after the ecology and everything was organic and lots more flowers and trees. And then, because that's the insect food, all the flowers, you know, they're the pollinators and everything else. So then after a couple of years of noticing really high insect numbers, we started to notice the birds coming in. Now, you know, going from an empty, bare, large area of very short grass and sheep to, like, trees that are a wide, diverse range of amazing trees, fruit trees and all the support trees that go with fruit trees and forest gardens and a lot of trees and a lot of vegetables as well, Kawanga seed gardens as well, loads of flowers there. So then the birds started coming in, and we've got a guy here who's, like, a bird. He's really into birds, and he's got lists of all the birds we've got here, and every year there's new birds we haven't seen before.
Wow.
And there's heaps and heaps of birds. And then I started hearing stories about – so we're working with some gardens around Lake Taupo at the moment. Someone there was telling us how the phosphate cycle used to work on Lake Taupo, and used to be lots of native fish in the lake, and mm-hmm. there used to be lots of the birds that used to eat the fish, and then they'd nest on the all the banks and the shores of the lake, and then the phosphate it comes out of the bird manure, the bird poo.
Right.
I mean, that's what we're mining in Africa and in Jordan. We're mining thousands of years of mountains of bird, you know, the bird waste,
yep.
Because there's no rain over there. There's hardly any rain, so it doesn't wash away. It just accumulates and accumulates and becomes rock over thousands and thousands of years. So in New Zealand, the phosphate was coming out of the water and out of the life in the water and out of the fish and up onto the land. And apparently the same thing happened with the whales. Like, when there were loads of whales, they eat things from the bottom of the ocean where there's lots of phosphate, and then they come to the surface and their poo floats on the surface.
Really?
Yeah, and the birds eat that, all the seabirds, and
wow.
They cycle the phosphate back onto the land. So this was happening in our ecologies and our environment in a way we didn't fully understand. And we've broken all of those links, like we've annihilated the whales and we've put trout in Lake Taupo so the native fish aren't there anymore, and the birds that used to eat the native trout have disappeared, and like we're breaking the link. So what we've in effect done is, by destroying the ecology, you know, the connections between all the different layers of life, because of the way we live and, you know, the way our food is grown and the way we manage our animals, we've broken the links and we've stopped the cycling of phosphate and many other things in our ecology. So I came to see and understand that on a personal home scale level, if we like recreate amazing environments where we've got organic gardening and we've got the loads of flowers and the insects coming back and the birds coming back, then it's the insect manure, the bird manure, and all the animal manure, which is where the phosphate is getting cycled. So in a home garden, one of the things I'd love to try, but I'm too scared to try, is in the Middle East, they have dovecots in all their gardens, and the doves bring in high phosphate manure and drop it around the garden and in the dovecot, which is then used in the garden. I haven't tried that one yet, but there could be a lot of people that would be really useful for, because especially people living near like a lot of native bush and stuff, because the doves will just go out, the pigeons will just go out and eat food all through the forest, and I don't know how that will compete with. That could create other disturbances. So we do have to be very mindful of everything we do. Anyway, the long-term solution is obviously rebuilding our ecological strength and resilience so that we have loads of insects. Like, there's a huge crash in insect numbers worldwide, and that's affecting lots of other things. But one of the things that's affecting, which no one's talking about, is the phosphate cycling. And it affects the bird numbers. the birds come when there's something for them to eat, and a lot of them eat insects. So the birds come, and then they're phosphate cycling. And then if we've got bigger areas of land, I mean, the way to manage it really, if you've got a farm and you've got animals, is management intensive grazing, because immediately the grass goes from having, like, you know, an inch of grass or 2 inches, you know, hardly any grass above the ground. And if you've only got, like, I'm supposed to be in centimetres, aren't I? If you've only got, like, 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 centimetres of grass above the ground, that's how much roots you've got below the ground.
Right.
The roots are only going as deep as the top. And if you've demineralised the topsoil, how the hell is that grass going to, like, nourish any animals? And so you've got to support your animals with all kinds of injections and drenches and all kinds of horrendous practices which go on all the time. And you're constantly further demineralising the soil and poisoning it and the humans who eat the food. So management intensive grazing is really simple. It takes more human hours, but you get way more. You become solar grass farmers, like, and you really get to see the potential of our land and the health of our animals. And so you manage the animals, you shift them every day pretty much. I mean, there's variations and you can do it differently, but you let the grass get to flowering, just starting to go to seed, and then you eat it down, trash it into the ground to feed the microbes, eat the best top off, trash some of it to feed the microbes, and you never eat it down to the ground, so it comes away much faster. You just grow more grass, the roots go deep, and you're just accessing far more minerals. The species change. Like, if you are managing your grass and letting it go to flower, the species really radically change very fast, because the ones that like deep roots and like need to be let to grow longer just end up disappearing when you keep the grass short all the time. You only end up with white clover and ryegrass, right, and a few weeds and thistles. But if you let it grow long, you get all kinds of stuff coming in, which is much more, much deeper roots, much like, there's all plantain and red clover and loads of things, dandelions. They've got deep tap roots. They contain a lot more minerals and nutrients. The animals are much healthier. The amount of animals you can feed on the same area goes up, so you make a lot more money. You have to spend more on time because there's more time involved, but you end up better off. So, and so does the ecology, and so do the animal soil health. You're building soil, you're building animal health and human health, because the food's way better quality. So it's much easier on the land than it is in a garden, but it all comes down to long-term, like, making short-term decisions which support long-term ecological health and resilience, biodiversity and integration, like wide range of stuff there, but with connections between it all. So it's rebuilding the connections that we've broken, you know, right, maybe an unconscious way over the last couple of hundred years. So it's all about ecological health and resilience.
I went on to ask Kay many questions that broke down everything she had just told me. I was fascinated. You can find that full conversation online, especially if you want to get more involved in this movement to a return of regenerative farming, a way of engaging with the ecosystem that was all happening up until pastoral farming was introduced during colonisation. But now, continuing with the science of this conversation, like I've said before, this investigation has basically developed itself. The next step has continued to present itself to me as the clear next step right when I need it. After first learning about phosphate and then talking to the companies who were importing it from the other side of the world, I literally happened to be driving along a country road and happened to see a board advertising a company called AgriSea New Zealand Seaweed. I saw the word seaweed and I saw nutrients. I googled them and it turns out this is a New Zealand company specialising in the manufacture of macroalgae concentrates and bioactive extractions to add high-value nutrition for soil, plant, animal and human health. Wait a minute. They sell seaweed to add nutrients to soil? Is this a possible alternative to the superphosphate option currently being used a lot? Maybe too much? Who are AgriSea and how did they come about?
AgriSea was actually started by my mother-in-law and father-in-law almost accidentally in the 90s. They were teachers at that time and they went on what's called a woofing trip around the country, and they travelled across the country and seen a whole lot of really, really bad, unhealthy farms, some good farms, and then came across a farm that was just stunning. It had really green pastures, the animals were really in good condition, and it was one of those summers where it was fungal and there was a lot of disease around. And they spoke to the German operators of this farm, and their main input was seaweed. And they kind of thought, oh, wow, you know, what's all this about? And it's one of those things that once you know something, you kind of can't unknow it. And so they started experimenting in their backyard, researching seaweeds all around the world, then researching seaweeds in New Zealand, what species we have, what are they good for, what's their nutrient composition, and, yeah, started making basically ferments in their backyard and trialling them, and then word got out to their neighbours and then local rose clubs, and then, you know, next it was kiwi fruit growers and apple growers. So we've kind of, yeah, built a business almost accidentally. It wasn't necessarily the vision initially, but once they made that decision to sell products for people whom their land is their living, it started them on quite a different path in terms of investment and research and development to, you know, make sure these products work in these kind of monocultural growing systems.
So they, it was really simply from seeing the difference between a farm that was being sort of fed seaweed and farms that weren't.
Exactly.
That was Claire Bradley, the research coordinator at AgriSea. After understanding more about the process of regenerative farming, which is absolutely a long-term solution, I wanted to know more about products available right now that could be alternatives to getting phosphate from a disputed area in the middle of a colonial conflict that the UN has been unable to resolve since 1991. With New Zealand being one of the last countries to still engage and import that disputed phosphate, back to Claire here in Aotearoa. Okay, so in terms of what you guys are doing right now, like what sort of products do you actually provide?
Yeah, so we've got a range that all our products are certified organic, although 98% of our customers are non-organic, which is quite interesting. We make a range for animal nutrition. We've got a PhD student down at Lincoln University who's kind of providing all the data of what our farmers have been telling us for years, so that's starting to have publishable papers this year, which is interesting. And then we make products, basically it's like a probiotic for the soil, basically feeds the soil biology, and those soil biology can make nutrients available to plant roots. We also make a foliar spray that goes really heavily used in kiwi fruit, avocados, grapes, and is exported to Italy for viticulture there.
Amazing.
So yeah, they're basically a range of fermented products out of a single species of kelp at this point, and for soil plants and animals.
Okay, so let's start with something easy maybe. Why is seaweed so good?
Well, it's one of the most complex materials known to man. It has 20 of the 21 known amino acids. It has a really huge array of vitamins and minerals and nutrients. And, you know, internationally there are 10,000 species and there's still a lot of potential to be unlocked in those seaweed species. New Zealand has close to 1,000 species and there's been a bit of media around one of the red species and its ability to kind of stop methane and cow's burps. So, it's kind of a new frontier of research, especially for New Zealand. It's used quite well internationally, but... Yeah, it's just its complexity that really makes it of huge value.
That mention of the burps, I guess it's amazing. It's working incredibly on both sort of sides of the process at the start with the soil and the grass, I guess, in terms of what the cows are eating. But then even on the other side, it's lowering the sort of bad stuff.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And some of the data that's coming out from our PhD is around some urinary nitrogen reduction in the cow's urine, so therefore potential leaching reductions through our soils as well. So, yeah, I think, New Zealand has a huge opportunity to recognise the seaweed's importance ecologically in the marine ecosystem as well as, you know, potential economics as well.
So let's, I guess, talk about the nutrients then. So there's my understanding is that obviously you need nutrients to grow, as a fairly basic principle. But obviously, yeah, when you have cows or kiwi fruits, they are taking stuff from the soil when they eat or when they grow. And so is it necessary that there be a process of restoring those nutrients?
Yeah, I think there is, absolutely, especially some soils are inherently deficient in certain nutrients. But also I think that while the chemistry is well understood and the physical properties of compaction and aeration and this sort of thing, you know, it's very well recognised in the Ministry for Environment's 2018 report, we just don't have the data around the soil biology, and that's a third of the equation. While adding nutrients is one way, there is a fair bit of nutrient content in the soil particles themselves, so it's releasing those through soil microbiology.
So, soil microbiology, what is that?
Okay, so think of your gut, and we're understanding a whole lot more about our gut microbiome and how that enhances all properties in our body. The soil is like the stomach of the plant, and it's those, all those bacteria, fungi, nematodes, worms, you know, they're the kind of the elephants of the soil, if you like. There are a whole lot of organisms. I think we probably understand more about the stars than we do about what's under our feet in terms, wow, of the microbiome. Yeah, we know kind of less than 1% of the names of things that live in soil.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
And we put that in our mouth, essentially.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so in terms of, I guess, developing, well, not only developing our knowledge around that, but soil microbiology, if that's what we're dealing with, and the way that we've dealt with it for, you know, since we started doing pastoral farming, I suppose, is that you put the cows there, they eat the food, and then you replenish it, and then that's the cycle.
Yep.
Now, what I did speak, this is what I said in terms of regenerative farming. So before that was happening, there were all of these ecological links, right, where animals were eating things and then pooing things, and then the cycle was happening like that. And what was in the nutrients in that excretion was actually enough to continue to replenish the nutrients and continue the cycle.
I think one of the other really, really key points in the way we've run our pastoral farming is that we've gotten rid of any plant diversity in our pastures.
Right.
So we've gone to a rye clover base. And farmers who are experimenting with adding, you know, up to 20 different species in their paddocks are having huge results in terms of soil quality building, organic matter, soil carbon, but also animal health and production. There's research out of Switzerland that shows, you know, species diversity in terms of plants will outdo nitrogen fertilizer addition in terms of dry matter production any day.
Wow.
So I think I think that's one of the main problems that we've got, have just gone to this rye grass and clover mix that needs fertilizer to work.
Yeah.
Whereas if you've got diversity of plant species, they're communicating to each other, they're feeding each other, they're through the soil microbiome, and it'll outdo those inputs.
Right. Okay. I probably will come back to that because I feel like I could just talk about this all day. It's fascinating. Let's talk about phosphate. So phosphate is only one of the nutrients that we're kind of talking about, but it seems to be a fairly important one.
Yes.
What? Yeah. I guess what is phosphate? That's a good way to start.
Yeah, so I guess, phosphate is essential for plant growth. Plants need to access nitrogen, phosphate, and a range of other nutrients. I think, again, the Ministry for Environment report shows that 51% of dairy farms have excess soil phosphorus. So they're above their target range for Olsen P. So that means that we're putting on too much. We're putting on far too much. Our farmers have been sold too much. And we're not taking into the account the kind of biological actions of the soil microbiome in terms of those soil equations for phosphate levels.
Is that because it's sort of a quick fix, you know, like it's something that just works, so we'll just do that, and it's possibly more straightforward than trying to create diverse grass, for example?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the story, isn't it, that, you know, we've been told. And, you know, people, even companies such as Monsanto, are now looking at soil microbiome and farming and synthesizing microbes to give your soil. So it's happening already overseas. That technology is not widespread here in New Zealand. And so farmers stick to what they know.
Mm. And that, I suppose, it's not like, as a farmer, wherever you are doing whatever sort of farming, you don't have heaps of time perhaps to be doing all the research on that, right? There's cows to be milked and so on.
Exactly.
So what are the adverse effects of having too much Olsen P?
Well, there's, I guess, those interactions with your soil nutrients. So sometimes an excess of one nutrient can cause deficiencies or lock-ups of other nutrients. So you can get quite skewed results in your soil tests. Even things like your pH, how acidic if your soil is, will tell you different levels of availability in terms of phosphate. So having excess, yeah, you just, you basically... yeah, compromising the rest of the nutrients. The other issue is phosphorus is really a key player in the eutrophication of our waterways. Mm. So you get a little bit of runoff, and that you only need a small concentration of phosphorus to have really adverse effects on our waterways.
So that is a huge contributing factor to our dirty water.
Absolutely.
Whoa. Okay,
yeah.
And if we take a step back, so if people were putting, if there's too much phosphorus going into the soil, then if we take a step back, we don't actually need that much going into the soil, then we don't actually need to be getting that much from overseas, because that's where we get our phosphate.
That's exactly right.
And we get a lot of our phosphate, in particular, from the Western Sahara, Morocco region. So what do you know about the situation in Western Sahara?
I know it's a pretty dire situation. It's a very long-term situation. It's a complex situation, but it's also a situation that I feel as a New Zealander we should not be having any part of. I spoke with the Prime Minister when she visited us this year, and she went to those camps in 2008 and witnessed the atrocities that are basically happening in that area. So, yeah, from a personal level, as a New Zealander, I would want nothing to do with the, you know, supporting that trade.
And so what do you guys do instead? Do you get phosphate, or what is it that you do? Is the seaweed enough in terms of not using that?
Well, no, the seaweed's not enough in a lot of situations. So we kind of, you know, we not telling a farmer how to farm. They will use the seaweed as a biostimulant, which will stimulate the soil microbiome, which lessens their reliance on other fertilisers. So they actually work quite well in combination. It's not a full replacement for nutrients, but it's an enhancement of your soil.
Mm. And it's because of the process in which, like you said in the emails, seaweed biostimulants have been shown to improve mycorrhizal fungi colonisation.
Yep.
So
yep.
So you're saying that actually the seaweed helps to open up the roots, or if I'm not really understanding it right, am I?
So mycorrhizal fungi are incredible beings, if you like. They extend the reach of the roots, hairs. I'm not sure. I think it's about, the research shows they get about 10 times more water and nutrients when plants are associated with these fungi. So they just get this huge network, and that's one of their main roles, mycorrhizal fungi, is not only bringing soil water to the plant, but also phosphorus. When you add synthetic phosphorus, there's quite a few studies showing that actually inhibits the spores of the mycorrhizal fungi doing their job.
Right. Okay, so it's actually working backwards.
Yeah, you're working against kind of nature, if you like.
I'm going to try and bring these together, but let me see if I can pull the threads together. What we've talked about is the seaweed as works together, right? It's a thing that you can work not as a complete substitute, but
an enhanced of any sort of kind of fertilizer that you've put on.
Right. And in that process, it probably means that you don't need to rely on fertilizers as much, or at least the quantity of those.
Absolutely.
So it would reduce the kind of the demand for the amount of phosphate that we are getting from overseas.
Absolutely.
Okay, so if we are using these sorts of products, and because we get the majority of our phosphate from this disputed area, because it does hold the majority sort of source of phosphate in the whole world, it would lessen our reliance on that area.
Absolutely.
So Ravensdown, when they sent me a whole bunch of information, they said, this is a quote, "There is currently no alternative that comes without significant environmental impacts, processing costs, miscellaneous supply risk, and other human rights implications at the source," end of quote. Now, this, what we're talking about in terms of agri-C, is an option, and it possibly, yes, would require, you know, further research or further money to actually develop the process.
Yeah, I think the key thing is that internationally there is technology around soil microbiome and how that unlocks phosphorus and can be used as alternatives. The problem is that there is not the research done here in New Zealand. There is the funding for that research so far here in New Zealand. So the problem with the funding model is it has to have a kind of commercial gain, but there needs to be some independent research on the role of soil microbiology in releasing soil phosphorus for farmers. Farmers deserve that research.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. Support 95 BFM with a B-card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.